This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the LGIM investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. If you're enjoying LGIM Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcast or Spotify app to make sure you never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy and Research, and Chris Jeffrey, Head of Rates and Inflation Strategy. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Since our last call in August, the easing of global lockdowns remains halting at best. Brexit has returned to the headlines, and market volatility has ticked higher. On that note, Sonia, could you please talk us through the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets?
With great pleasure. Thank you very much, Max, and good morning, everyone. As always, first and foremost, most importantly, I hope you're joining us healthy and safe. And I'm delighted to be joined by Ben and Chris today, because we will really put a spotlight on global bond markets and the latest central bank news. But before we do that, I will, as usual, give you some updates on what's been happening in global markets and the economy. And as always, I will kick off with a few thoughts on the virus development. We clearly had a massive increase in terms of the news around the virus, and we have seen a lot of new cases in areas where we thought we obviously have been down to a path of of easing. And it's clear if you look at the slide right now in front of you that, yes, we've spent a lot of time focusing on emerging markets because they clearly have been in the spotlight. Then we have focused back on the US because they were grappling with their second wave. And now we're back into Europe, where we have seen clearly an increase in new cases. We are now using here Spain to evidence that development, and you see very clearly that they are now fighting a very severe second phase. And on the back of this, we have seen a lot of new restrictions being imposed, most and foremost around traveling. And here in the UK in particular, we've had a flurry of new announcements around quarantine rules. And we have to assume that this will clearly be with us because we are now entering the autumn period. And with that, we obviously will see a much greater focus on indoor activity, and we have to assume that new cases will remain on the rise for quite some time. Now, the vaccine, as we've debated a number of times during previous calls, is obviously kind of the silver lining in terms of a full return to normalization. But again, here we've probably had mixed news at best because AstraZeneca yesterday had to announce a setback in their testing. And I think we have to be very realistic that there will be more negative and a more balanced picture going forward. So although we have had good news and we still have the baseline in terms of an expectation of a vaccine at the second quarter next year, but again, we have to understand that if that were not to materialize, this would have a negative impact clearly on the expectation around the economic growth picture and markets. Now, with regards to the economic development, not a lot new, really, after what we've discussed during our last call. As we've discussed back then, we have now established a central economic growth scenario, which, as you might recall, sits right in the middle between the scenario 1 and 2, and this is really signified by, very neatly shown here in the picture, a very sharp V-shaped recovery initially, followed by more sluggish growth. And it's very clear, obviously, that vaccine plays a fundamental role in how this economic growth picture can potentially change. Because the sooner we get the vaccine, the earlier we can get to full normalization. The later the vaccine is coming, obviously, the more we have to assume that social distancing and localized restrictions will remain in place. Stimulus is another important factor in that equation. And as you might have seen, obviously, the U.S. is still debating for another stimulus package, and we're now waiting whether this can happen actually, in fact, before the U.S. elections, or whether they will drag it out until then. But clearly, markets in particular have reacted very positively on the back of the fiscal and monetary policy announcement. Now, in terms of the risks to our central scenario, you see here quite a nice kind of visualization of those. And not surprisingly, it's all topics we've discussed before. Economic scouring clearly is one that we've spent a lot of time on, i.e. understanding what are the long-term implications of the pandemic. And we've highlighted in, during prior calls that clearly we are seeing an acceleration in global trends and the long-term thematic trends that we have been debating. And we have to assume that those kind of accelerations will probably produce reallocation effects across global labor markets. And as such, you know, we will have to be very open to potential changes to our forecast. Now, with that in mind, I would like to now move on to look at markets, because clearly, as discussed before, markets have been very quick in discounting the unprecedented stimulus coming from governments and central banks. And equity markets in particular show the same V-shaped recovery than we have seen in the early economic indicators. And we've highlighted during our last call, when we focused on Q2 earnings, that clearly we have seen a very distinct kind of diverse development between some sectors. And there's a clear kind of focus on pandemic winners versus pandemic losers. But even within sectors, we are seeing now that there's a clear focus on winners, the winners getting stronger, and those that probably entered the pandemic on a weaker footing, i.e. with either too high leverage or too weak a competitive positioning, are clearly suffering a lot more than their peers. We have focused before as well on the narrowness of the leadership, and we've had some very interesting statistics around the dominance of literally four stocks that are driving global equity markets, and is clearly something we have to be mindful of. These are all technology stocks. These are all companies that are benefiting from the pandemic, and all companies that obviously have been very well positioned prior to the pandemic. But nevertheless, if you have four companies that can drive global equity markets, it is clearly something we need to watch out for. As I highlighted right at the beginning, today we want to really focus on bond markets and the latest announcement from central banks. Because as you can see on the slide right in front of you now, we obviously have seen an equally dramatic move in bond yields globally, and that clearly is a topic that will make you wonder how you should think about your global bond allocation within your overall asset allocation mix. And as such, I'm delighted to be joined by Chris and Ben today, and would like to kick off with the first question to Chris, because we have actually had an announcement from the Fed recently that have shared some thoughts around their new policy framework.
Thanks, Sonia. So I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about what the Fed have told us. They've updated their long-run goals and monetary policy strategy. So this isn't about the kind of short-term. This is really about their big-picture thinking about how they operate over the course of the next couple of years. Investors clearly obsess about every dotted I and cross T in Federal Reserve communications, and this is quite a big one. But cutting through kind of what they said, there's really two parts to it. One is on the inflation side of their dual mandate, and one is on the employment side of their dual mandate. On the inflation side, they've told us they're moving to what has been called average inflation targeting. So to quote from their statement, following periods in which inflation has been running persistently below the 2% target, appropriate monetary policy will likely aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time. Now, for people who aren't monetary policy anoraks, that sounds like quite a small change. But for the Fed, this is a big, big statement, given that inflation has been running below target now for the last 8 years. So de facto, they're saying we're not going to be aiming for a higher number going forward than we have in the past. On the employment side, they're basically giving up on the idea that they can accurately measure full employment, and saying that they will no longer respond to deviations from the estimated maximum level in setting interest rates. So that's another way of saying they will not preemptively hike interest rates because they think the labor market is getting too tight. Now, as I said earlier, this is all quite anarchy, but I think the real sort of material way to think about this is, with these new two conditions in place, the last hiking cycle from December 2015 to December 2018 would never have happened. That was entirely a preemptive move on the expectation that inflation was going to pick up because of a tight labor market. So they're saying in the way, it's the closest you will ever get to the Fed's admitting that the last policy hiking cycle was a mistake. So let's kind of cut through this and think about what it might mean going forward. The previous head of the Federal Reserve said it was the central bank's job to take away the punch bowl just as the party was getting started. what Jerome Powell has just told us, is they have no intention of taking away the punch bowl preemptively in this cycle, and they intend to keep it topped up until the party is in full swing. So that's kind of my take on what the Fed have just told us. Maybe, Ben, do you kind of want to make some comments on whether you think this will have any traction in actually raising inflation and what it will mean for bond yields and the US dollar?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, I don't want to be too harsh on the Fed. Well, actually, I do. I quite enjoy being harsh on the Fed because, let's face it, they've pretty much failed to hit their mandate for, well, goodness knows how long. I mean, you can see in the chart that it's been a pretty poor showing. And that's their target, inflation. If you look at their forecast for inflation, it's even worse. They just keep forecasting going up. It never does. Well, never goes up as much as they think. And to be fair to them, they've got two tools, really. They can cut interest rates. They can do QE. And that's trying to impact inflation. Yet the evidence is that they haven't really been able to hit their inflation target. So they've done this big review, as Chris has said, Anoraki review. And I'd say a sort of one way of looking at it is that the tools don't work, you know. But they've decided the tools are perfectly fine. We just haven't done enough. I think that's a load of rubbish. If you look at Bank of Japan, they've been doing this for many more years, doing more stuff. They've changed their target, I think, haven't they? They've also been doing QE for many more years. They've been buying equities, they've been buying real estate, and yet they've also failed to hit their targets. I just don't buy it. I mean, maybe I'm being a bit harsh. Chris, are you a little bit more pro-Fed, or do you agree with me that this is all a little bit...
Like the cynical version of this would be the Fed is like a high jumper that's been trying to get over a 2-meter bar, and having failed to do that a couple of times, has just moved the bar to 2.5 meters in the hope that somehow they will have greater success. And the kind of Bank of Japan analogy, I think, is a good one here, right? Because the Bank of Japan, some of the specifics are quite extraordinary. So from 2012, they said our price stability goal is 1%. In 2013, it got changed from a goal to a target, and the number got changed from 1% to 2%. But now 7 years later, and inflation is 0.3. So it's not a kind of glorious track record of tweaking the targets and the goals and achieving nirvana here. I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. They're just saying, if the same conditions pertain that we had in 2015, we're not going to make the same mistake again. Donald Trump has been bashing the Fed repeatedly, month after month, calling them, quite impolite things at times. And this is their way of saying, you know what, Mr. President, maybe you were right on monetary policy.
Well, that's, yeah, again, I wouldn't want to criticize the Fed, but, yeah, well, let's see if that works. But I do think that it does have an impact, not necessarily on inflation. But look, if you've had zero interest rates and QE like we have had for many, many years, and then they've gone all in at the beginning of this year, and now they're going to say, like Chris was mentioning, that they're going to do more and more probably for longer, well, it keeps yields low, doesn't it? It keeps real yields low. It keeps liquidity sloshing around the system. And if you're buying corporate bonds or even equities, you know that the Fed has got your back. So from a pure markets perspective, I would say that this had a big impact. I just don't believe the inflation side, to be honest.
I think that's a very interesting point. And I'm going back to the slide that I showed earlier, because obviously, clearly, bond yields have moved to a level now that from an investor's point of view, if we now assume that clearly with a Fed policy, we have to assume that rates will remain low for a lot longer, and that policy measures, if they assume the two tools they have, they will use even more of to achieve their goal, then obviously the implications for markets are quite profound. And this is particularly in the context, I guess, from an asset allocation perspective, where it really matters. Because the way we're thinking about government bonds in particular as a diversification tool and a hedge to some extent, you wonder whether it can still work the same way as it has in the past. And likewise, now obviously showing a chart about credit, we obviously have a similar picture. You wonder whether where spread levels are today is really as attractive as it was, and how you should think about the allocation. Chris, from an asset allocation point of view, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head here. And actually, it links back to something that you said earlier. Even when you're thinking about kind of diversification within the equity market, it's getting harder and harder to find with the dominance of a few names. So just kind of make a couple of points. So one is, historically, it's often been better to travel than to arrive. So yes, in isolation, this communication is pretty unequivocal. It's good news for any real asset. It's bad news for the dollar, should drive real yields down. But those have all been the developments that we've kind of seen over the course of the last 3 to 6 months. And partly this has been in anticipation of this. I mean, the Fed have been talking about this review for 2 years now. It's like they finally got it over the line. In itself is sort of not the big thing going forwards. But I think then sort of structurally, it does mean you've just got to be looking for the diversification where you can find it going forward. So in particular, that kind of role of nominal yields as a buffer against aggregate demand shocks is going to be tricky. We can even see that this year. So, you know, Treasury total returns dwarfing those that we've seen in the German government bond market or the Japanese government bond market. It's not that those economies have been subjected to different shocks, just that the starting point in Germany and Japan was zero or below zero. There's just sort of no room to rally. So yeah, we have to be kind of looking for alternative assets to be adding into the mix. Some of those will be commodity linked, some of those won't be commodity linked, but we've kind of got to continue that search to be reaching into kind of return streams and income streams that are less traditional. Sorry, Max, you want to say something?
Yes, thanks, Chris. So the Bank of England is meeting later this week. Looking back again at the Fed review, can we draw any parallels with the UK? What's the domestic inflation outlook? And is something likely to come of all of this negative rates chatter?
Yep, I'll have a go at that. The negative rates chatter has ebbed and flowed in the UK, assisted by the Bank of England kind of being a bit lukewarm on it. And they're lukewarm on it, I think, for quite good reasons. But the UK does look different to the countries which have introduced negative interest rates. We run a persistent current account deficit in the UK. All of the countries with negative rates are persistent current account surplus countries. So we need, as a country, to be attracting capital from overseas, and putting interest rates below zero doesn't obviously engender that. So there's likely been bigger exchange rate impact in the UK than elsewhere. And secondly, the UK markets don't suggest any of the chronic low inflation problems that you've seen in Europe, Japan, Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland. So UK inflation expectations, both market-based and consumer-based, are pretty high in the UK. So there isn't kind of the need to do it. I don't think there's anything fundamentally different about the structure of the UK financial system that would make it impossible to introduce this as a policy here. And that's, I think, why the markets are kind of playing with it as an option. You see kind of pricing for next year has a pretty high risk now. We have something like -7 basis points priced in 6 months out for the Bank of England, which is kind of another way of saying the market's putting a 50% type probability on a decent cut into negative territory. So can't rule it out, but we'll just say the preconditions look quite different in the UK to elsewhere. Maybe I'd kind of pass over to Ben at this point to say a few words on UK credit and UK equities in this context.
Yeah, so what does it all mean? Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny enough, I was talking to Chris about this a few days ago about the Bank of England cut its negative rates. And I think we were firmer a few weeks ago saying that they probably wouldn't cut to negative. But look, I mean, if we had a second slump, I don't know what the correct phrase is, but, you know, if the furlough schemes roll off and we had a bit of a recession, then the Bank of England would probably do something, a bit like the Fed, even if it doesn't necessarily work or maybe even has some unintended consequence, they probably would do something. So maybe you can't rule it out, I guess, is the point. But in terms of market reaction, in terms of how it impacts the pound, I mean, Chris has already said weaker pound, but we all know something else going on in the background, don't we, which is also impacting the pound. And that's probably the most important thing, Brexit negotiations, which, as of speaking, aren't going particularly well. So, I mean, that's, for us, a big drag on the pound. I would say for credit markets, it's had very little impact. And look, like I said earlier, you know, if the Fed is buying corporate bonds, the Bank of England is buying corporate bonds. So you've got that as a, from a markets perspective, that's got your back. And from an equity perspective, it is all about the pound. You know, all these big companies in the UK that have lots of foreign income translated into pounds, if the pound is falling, that income goes up and up and up in pounds, doesn't it? So it's doing pretty well. I mean, I was just looking at the last week's worth of equity data, and Sonia was mentioning a correction in technology stocks, and actually the FTSE's up this week, but that's purely because the pound is down. So it's all a little bit confusing and complicated. I'd actually, one question, asset allocation question for Chris again, though. I mean, all this, all what's been going on in terms of the dollar being going down, more, you know, easier policy, et cetera, it's having some impact on gold, isn't it? Gold is the thing that's been going up this year. Is that telling us that inflation is coming around the corner, or is it people actually just thinking of fiat currency? These central banks are going crazy printing money. I just need to get something solid, or maybe it's a mixture of the two.
So Tim Drayson, our head of economics, has got a good kind of gold model, which is in one of the charts, which is not particularly complicated, but it is quite effective in helping us understand the drivers. It's saying that historically gold prices have been driven by a combination of real yields. So when real yields are negative, the incentive to hold a real asset with a zero nominal yield is quite attractive, one, and the US dollar, because when the dollar is weaker, then the ability of people outside of the US to buy gold denominated in dollars goes up. That explains the majority of the move that we've seen. So, yes, there's kind of lots of narrative out there about, is this a paradigm shift in inflation expectations? Are we seeing the breakdown of kind of trust in money? But what it looks like so far, primarily, not exclusively, there's a bit of an overshoot, but primarily, this is about real yields in the US being driven to European or close to UK levels with the Fed's new policy. And it's the dollar having been weak. I think just sort of one final point for sort of handing back. If we'd kind of gone pre-COVID and said, well, what's the biggest risk to the global economy? I think most people in that discussion would have said, well, it's a strong dollar, which drives up the funding costs for heavily leveraged economies, drives down the exchange rates for emerging markets, creates lots of financial stability risks. So one of the kind of, I sort of hate to say it, but one of the sort of positive financial market spillovers of what's happened is that kind of bid for the US dollar is completely evaporated and taken out that pretty existential debt risk. So clearly you kind of got to balance that against other things which have gone a lot worse in the last 6 months. But that dollar risk does seem to have dissipated. Max.
Thanks, Chris. Staying with that theme, we've just had two quite meaty questions come in from clients. We've got 7 minutes left, so I'll just put them to the room and then ask you to sum up. Sonia, so I'll just read these verbatim. One is, do you think there is a potential that continued government intervention may create systemic risk in the long term? And then the second one is inflation still an appropriate target for the Fed or the Bank of England in the current environment? Should they instead be looking at direct monetary financing or even QE in order to drive employment? So, Sonia, please.
Yeah, let me kick off particularly on the question around government intervention, because obviously the fiscal packages we have seen, I think, have been very welcomed, because you might recall that the debate, you know, whether monetary policy has reached its limit of effectiveness and how we can stimulate economic growth, obviously it has always been accompanied by the demand and the question for governments to step up and do more. And so I think this is clearly what we have now seen, and there has been an unprecedented flurry of government announcements. And we probably need to understand more around the immediate impact, obviously, has been very much on providing liquidity. It's been mostly liquidity measures. All the furlough schemes, the payment protection scheme in the US, obviously, have been focused on to relieve the immediate concern around liquidity issues. So these, obviously, we will watch very carefully, because as Ben just highlighted, when these roll off, we might see a bit of an impact, because that obviously means that companies will have to reassess, you know, their workforce and how many people they can probably employ in the context, obviously, a continued impact from the virus. I think the understanding of government interference more comes around the idea, how will they channel their investments going forward? And I think I assume that's what the question is asking for. We've had a lot of talk and focus on a green deal and making the recovery a green recovery, where very clearly the government will have to channel very carefully and will attach objectives and outcomes to respective funding. So I think that's something we don't have a lot of clarity yet, because although we have heard big announcements in terms of the total packages, we haven't had a lot of detail yet on how this money, in fact, will be allocated. I think that's particularly clear around the European Commission's package, where clearly 25% is earmarked for green projects. But again, it's been very light on detail yet. And as we know, the devil is in the detail when it comes to those allocation mechanisms. But that probably is the one we have to watch very carefully to make sure we have a good understanding on the potential market implications. Now, with regards to the Fed, I will hand over to Ben first, but I'm sure Chris has something.
Oh, I was going to pass it straight on to Chris on the Fed. That's definitely not my area of expertise. But just to reiterate some of the conclusions Sonia said on the spending. It really just depends on whether it's productive spending for me. A little bit of spending can be productive, but if you just keep going year after year and get addicted to it, which governments can be addicted to it, then I'm a big worrier about too much government, too much fiscal spending. As Sonia said, at the minute, governments are basically handing out cash to people and businesses who are then choosing what to spend it on. So it's okay at the minute. But yeah, for the question, I do think there is a risk. But yeah, onto Fed policy, I think it's all quite political, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, I was just going to actually make a comment on the spending side. So, I mean, if we kind of think about the UK numbers, I think it's a really good example of this debate. So entire public sector payroll in the UK, out of all of the civil servants, all the people who work in the NHS, you get to about 5.5 million. If you add up the furlough scheme and the self-employment income support scheme, you get to a number that's just over double that at its peak. So clearly that's a necessary, magnificent intervention in the short term to stop incomes collapsing. But also clearly you can't do that forever. You cannot operate with a model where you're paying twice as many people to be on furlough as you are to work in the public sector. And yeah, I mean, winding that down is going to be very, very challenging. But it's inevitable. You can't pick all the economy in aspic for however long it takes and hope that no structural change is taking place. On the kind of shift of targets, I think the Fed here is interesting because the Fed actually has already got. Everyone talks about a dual mandate, but actually that's a triple mandate. There's three statutory obligations to maintain price stability, maintain full employment, and then the one that nobody dares speak about, but it's in there in the legislation, is to keep the structure of interest rates low. And that third one, I think, has been the one that they don't want to say it because it's sort of slightly uncomfortable, but it's probably been a big driver. In the UK, it is a statutory inflation objective, but there's lots of wording in the legislation about supporting the secondary objectives of the government. I think there's been plenty of flexibility in the way that the bank has operated, which says they're not sort of slavish about that inflation target in a way that we maybe kind of could worry about from the headline. So I think we're already there, to be honest. I don't think we need to change things.
Sonia, is there anything you'd like to add before we finish up today?
Yes, I think it's worth just bringing it all together again to make sure that the investor's perspective is fully captured here. Because it's very clear, you know, all the charts we showed you and what we said today obviously point to the fact that, you know, you probably want to think very carefully around the risk-reward profile of various asset classes. We've touched very much today on government bonds and credit today, but clearly, you know, when you look at equity markets, as we've highlighted, the narrowness in leadership and the skew that you find in markets clearly points to a real shift in obviously the opportunity set. What we haven't touched on today is obviously the upcoming, you know, more political and geopolitical events. And clearly, there's a lot of potential for increased volatility. You will hear us talk more about the US election coming up. But with markets having developed so well over the past couple of months, we have to assume that there is room for more volatility simply because of obviously an increased focus on the narrative of the two candidates. The China-US relation will definitely come back into focus. And we've mentioned the Brexit word right at the beginning, but clearly right now it seems that this is not going particularly well. So the negative sentiment might again increase here. We've had the impact on sterling. And so I wanted to finish just on this idea of the acceleration of long-term themes, because clearly what we're seeing here is an acceleration in that trend. Technology has been the clear winner, but if you think about the thematic of technology, it's clearly nothing that we've only discussed since the pandemic started. It's been a long-term driver of fundamental shifts and changes. And it's more the understanding on how the pandemic will accelerate or shift nuances within those themes. you know, I think even the on the medical side, i.e. in the big demographics picture, the pandemic has uncovered obviously the need for greater global collaboration and the way we can think about development of vaccines, drugs and the likes. And the reason I'm pulling this out here is because I think we agree this, where markets are, we need to be more selective, because the opportunity set looks very different, and understanding the implications that will arise long-term from the pandemic and what structurally will emerge as opportunities, we believe is incredibly important at this point. ESG, green recovery, came up as well, clearly a topic that we need to focus on a lot more, but just thought this is a nice way of bringing it all together, and obviously will link back to lots of the other episodes we had on the CIO Outlook, and hopefully is useful for you to think about. And with that, I will hand back to Max.
Thank you very much for that, Sonia. That's a great point on which to end this week's call, which has been a fascinating discussion, from talk of the strong getting stronger to the Fed's bubbling punch bowl and spending addiction. So I'd like to thank you, Chris and Ben, for your time today. And I'd like to thank our clients for logging in. As ever, our podcast listeners can find a link to the slides in this episode's show notes. We'll see you again next time on the 8th of October, when Sonia will be joined by John Rowe and Nick Stansbury.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.